This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's Thursday on Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. Chris Quinn here with Lisa Garvin, Layla Tassi, and Laura Johnston. And before we start, a couple of things to clarify. We talked earlier in the week about the park that is no longer being built at MetroHealth, and we talked about some of the timing. After we looked at the timeline, it does appear the county approved the taxpayers guaranteeing the bonds for the MetroHealth expansion absent the discussion of the park. Since then, after that approval, there were quite a few public meetings involving that park, and we know there were a lot of angry people about it. We're going to continue to explore it, but the guarantee was not based on the park. And the second thing was, I mentioned yesterday that I put a text out about the $1.2 billion that Dee and Jimmy Haslam want the taxpayers to put up for their Browns Playhouse. Got 400 plus texts in response, and not 10 of them supported them. Most were aghast that the Haslams could make such an absurd request to the taxpayers and want that discussion stopped immediately. Okay, let's get to today's news. Why is Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost joining with some counterparts in other states to stop Joe Biden's policy on transgender students? Laura.
You don't think this is just a dog whistle, do you, Chris? We normally think of Title IX as colleges spending equal amounts of money on sports for men and women. That's the first thing that comes to my head. But this is a big, obviously, federal requirement, and it seems like a little bit of a jump here. But Yost joined the GOP attorneys general in Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, Virginia, and West Virginia to sue the administration of Biden over changes in Title IX to protect transgender students. They say these changes trample over the lawmaking power of Congress. What is interesting is he's really just changing something that President Trump had changed. And basically, this rule, which takes effect August 1st, means that transgender students will be able to use school bathrooms, locker room, changing facilities, student housing, just like anybody else.
It is the dog whistle. Dave Yost has done this repeatedly through his time as attorney general. Mike DeWine did too. It's not something that Dave Yost created, but it's just, let's get together and go after some super conservative issue and put the screws to the Democrats. We see these fairly regularly. It's almost like Dave Yost realizes he hasn't been in the media for a few weeks, looks for an issue to get him out there. And it works because we're talking about it.
Right. So Yost had a press release, put it out about this lawsuit, said transgender girls and women would be allowed to play female sports under the rule change. Now, Ohio just recently passed a law saying they can't play in high school sports. But Title IX, in its original form, and its 50-year-old law, acknowledges the enduring physical differences between men and women, permitting the maintenance of sex-segregated space such as bathrooms, locker rooms, and student housing. That's what Yost is pointing to, saying the Biden's rules go against that.
Okay. You're listening to Today in Ohio. All right. Before we start this next discussion, I want to say a couple things. We're about to talk about what's happening in Gaza. And we are getting communication from people on this very sensitive issue that try to caution us on what we do. So I want to point out, if you are opposed to the violence that's happening in Gaza, it doesn't mean you're anti-Semitic. You can disagree with what Israel does and not be anti-Semitic. And if we say anything about the protests, it doesn't mean we're somehow condoning what Hamas did to Israel. That was abhorrent and everybody knows it. We're talking about the college protests here. And we're speaking about that as objectively as news people should. And if you don't like the way we're wording it, we're following our own compass. What we want to talk about here is what Sherrod Brown says about what's happening with the protests and what our congressional delegation, how they voted on a move yesterday to redefine anti-Semitism for legal purposes. Layla, let's start with Sherrod.
Well, yes. Yeah, so as everyone knows, police have been arresting protesters on college campuses, sometimes in altercations that have escalated to violence. And Sherrod Brown has really no criticism for that police response. He said his colleagues who have condemned police use of force against protesters don't speak for him. He also thinks that the students' demands that their universities divest from Israel isn't even legal under Ohio law. His strongest words were really for the protesters. He said, quote, "Fundamentally, I think that anti-Semitism and hate and violence are unacceptable on campuses. If students want to make their voices heard, they need to do it in a way that's nonviolent, and they need to do it in a way that doesn't spew hatred, and the laws need to be enforced." So it seems that Brown is trying to speak more forcefully against the protests because he was recently quoted saying that people always have the right to speak out and should. And that immediately became a campaign fodder for his opponent, Bernie Moreno, who called it a full-throated endorsement of the protests, which he characterizes as spewing pro-Hamas and anti-Semitic garbage and intimidating and targeting Jewish students and professors.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised at that take because it does kind of remove the thought that students may just be taking offense at the continuing slaughter that's happening. Many in the world are calling for a ceasefire, calling for peace to figure out how to move forward. A lot of innocents continue to be killed, and many of the students, that's what they're saying. They want that to stop. It doesn't mean they're anti-Semitic. Doesn't mean they support Hamas. What about this redefining of the term anti-Semitism?
Well, so as part of a Republican drive to quash the campus protests, the GOP-controlled House of Representatives on Wednesday passed a bipartisan bill that aims to help enforcement of anti-discrimination laws by setting an official definition of anti-Semitism. This is the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act of 2023. It was adopted in a 320-91 vote, and it requires the use of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism in enforcing Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That bars discrimination based on ethnicity, ancestry, or national origin at federally funded schools. And so the definition of anti-Semitism that this embraces is, quote, "a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred toward Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish community institutions and religious facilities." And the only Ohio Congress members who didn't support the bill were Warren Davidson, who is a Miami County Republican who voted against it, and Akron Democrat Amelia Sykes, who did not vote.
You do have to be careful with things like this, because if you define it too stringently, you're getting in the way of free speech and the First Amendment. And so there are groups Yes. that are alarmed by what's happening here. But then you have Max Miller, who saw a sign at one of the protests that said "Final Solution," which is a clear anti-Semitic sign referring back to Hitler's treatment of Jewish people and the 6 million that died in World War II. So it's tough. And what you really would like to see Congress get behind is, let's stop. Let's stop the killing and figure out the way forward. I'm not sure passing a law like this does anything other than a little bit of a symbolic gesture.
Well, I mean, I think it will have a chilling effect on free speech. I mean, Max Miller said he felt that this would ensure anti-Semitic hate crimes on college campuses are properly investigated and prosecuted. But as we've seen, there is a conflation of the notion of people protesting the indiscriminate violence and killing in Gaza and anti-Semitism. These are completely separate ideas. And I think that, you know, people have been raked across the coals for saying something like, you know, Israel is an apartheid state. That is, a lot of people feel that's an objective fact when you consider how it's been, you know, how Palestinians have been treated. And I feel like, if people feel like their words are going to be used and manipulated in that way, this is incredibly dangerous, something like this. I mean, even Jerry Nadler, who is Jewish and describes himself as a deeply committed Zionist, is opposed to this. He said he spent much of his life fighting anti-Semitism, but the bill's wording could end up improperly labeling a speech that is critical of Israel alone as unlawful discrimination and end up suppressing protected speech that criticizes Israel.
Yeah, I just don't think, though, if somebody were to be charged under that for saying something like that, I don't think it would stand, because that's ridiculous. But you get your point. Your other point is the one that is key. Simply opposing the violence is not anti-Semitism. But when you have the Fox Newses of the world making this a binary issue, one or the other, without the middle, and people watch that and they get all fired up. I've seen the email from people that are trying to make these arguments, and it's, you are completely okay to say, I want this violence to stop. I want Israel to stop. We need to cease fire. That's the U.S. position. Blinken has been over there saying, cease fire. We need to see this through and figure out the right way to move forward. Doesn't mean you're anti-Semitic. I mean, there are a whole bunch of people in Israel that are not supportive of their leader.
Right.
And if he were up for re-election tomorrow, he would lose. This is not what it is being painted as in some quarters in America.
But I will say, let me say this, though, and I mean, you're blaming right-wing media, but I think once the protest starts, all nuance is lost. You're either on one side or the other. That's kind of how protests work in a way. So,
but it doesn't make you anti-Semitic.
No, it doesn't. But that nuance, when people are screaming and yelling and waving signs, that nuance gets lost.
I want to say, I feel, so in every group, there will always be a few outliers who take advantage of the situation as an opportunity to carry out some wayward agenda. And I think that's what we're seeing with the few who have held up, you know, anti-Semitic messages. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't invalidate the overarching purpose and message of these protests, which are about the loss of innocent civilian lives in Gaza, which have climbed well beyond 30,000, including 14,000 mm-hmm. children. These protests are not inherently anti-Semitic. Let's not conflate a political statement against apartheid and genocide in a foreign country with a hatred of Jews. They are not the same. And many Jewish Americans completely understand that and sympathize with what the protesters are doing here. Republicans are just, to Chris's point, seizing upon this as yet another opportunity to stoke the culture wars. They know that their political opponents, like Sherrod Brown, like Joe Biden, are in a very tight spot when it comes to these issues. And that's so advantageous to Republicans during an election year. But instead of a knee-jerk reaction against the protests because Democrats are afraid of being labeled anti-Semitic, the Democrats should be loudly, forcefully making the point that we just made, that these are not anti-Semitic protests, but rather protests mm-hmm. against the indiscriminate killing of Palestinians, and that Americans should be given a wide berth to protest in a lawful way.
And America should get more fully behind the idea of a ceasefire. We should believe and stand for peace, which is where this needs to get. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Baldwin Wallace University has been in the news this year because, like many higher education institutions, it has serious financial troubles. Wednesday brought more big news from the school with a side helping of news about one of our favorite people to talk about Ohio politics. Lisa, what's going on?
Yeah, President Bob Helmer is retiring after 12 years as Baldwin-Wallace University president. That will become effective at the end of June. And political science professor Thomas Sutton will be the interim president and provost as the search begins for a permanent successor. So Helmer just oversaw major budget cuts of $17 million at Baldwin-Wallace in hopes of balancing the budget by the 2024-25 school year. He said in a statement upon his retirement that he says, I'm confident I'm leaving Baldwin-Wallace prepared to continue its mission of providing education based on 21st century needs and based on the arts and sciences. So the cuts that he oversaw included 23 jobs, eliminating 9 academic programs, and extending the hiring freeze. Tuition revenue at Baldwin-Wallace is down by $16.2 million in the 2021-22 school year, and that's, you know, more than the 5 years prior. Enrollment is also down. It dropped from 3,816 students to 3,327 this fall. That's 489 fewer students.
I should say that he was in my Leadership Cleveland class of eight, 9 years ago and is generally well regarded. They've done a good job there. And why Baldwin Wallace is so important is because it is a melting pot of right and left leaning students. And you can't say that about every college campus. And they've walked the walk. It's a valued asset in Northeast Ohio. He's been a strong leader, but he's dealing with those financial headwinds that we've been talking about of late. His interim replacement, though, is somebody we talk about often. Who is it?
Political science professor Thomas Sutton, who we've quoted extensively in the past.
We love dealing with Tom. He's a smart guy who offers expert analysis of what's going on politically. Always a pleasure to deal with them. We've partnered with his department and Lauren Copeland out there repeatedly. And so when we saw he was the interim, it was like, okay, they picked a good guy to be interim. And congratulations to Tom. You're listening to Today in Ohio.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It seems like another spring without spring. We've had some warm days early, a bunch of cold ones, and now we're in the 80s. And it seems like that every year, with spring seeming to be our most fickle season. Laura, we went to the numbers to see if this is a false impression, or if it is real. What did the numbers show us?
Well, first, Zachary Smith and Rich Exner had to come up with a way that we could mine data rather than just saying, yeah, it feels like this every year. Do you remember what it was like in the past? Because once we get to summer, I think we all forget about what spring felt like. So they came up with this times when the average high over 7 day periods reached 65 degrees and stayed there. And if the average high fell back below 55 at any point, the clock would reset and we'd say spring had not started yet. So it had to get warm and stay warm for spring to be here. And that's what happens a lot in Northeast Ohio. You get this false spring. You get a couple of 70 degree days and then you get snow. That happened March 4th and 5th. We were in the 70s. Then we got our final inch of snow for the season. So the past weekend on Sunday, when the temperature hit 80, that was the 7 day average had just hit 65 degrees. That included a couple of days that week when, I don't know if you remember, but like I was definitely wearing a winter coat, wearing a soccer game one of those evenings while it was raining. So it got to that point, and we think we'll be pretty good from here on out. If you look at the forecast, it looks pretty nice. I went and bought plants to put in my planters. I got sweet potato vine, and they say, you know, if it goes below 50, those plants are toast. What's interesting is, you're right, Chris, we can talk about the cold weather and we can mention that, but then when does it get too hot to not be spring anymore? And I'm of the idea that if it's above 80, like I want to be in a pool. Like that's not spring to me anymore.
Well, in the fall, we do have a pretty decent transition, and we've done lots of stories looking at the numbers that in late September and October, we have a long string of days that are in pretty much the ideal zone. You're high 60s, low 70s, and we love our autumns. It's just they're heading into winter. But it does. We just don't get that feel in spring. It feels like you do get a few days, and then we get really annoyed because it's freezing or cold and rainy. And then you get to the mid-May, and you're racing into summer, and it just doesn't feel like spring is as steady a season as the others are.
Well, I agree with that. But when our start date was April 28th on Sunday, based on this whatever formula we came up with, that falls almost directly in the middle of all springs since 1970. 24 springs were earlier and 30 were later. So we're right in the sweet spot of when spring begins. Now, that doesn't mean that really tells us that we get all the perfect days. So when you get a perfect day, like Tuesday was just absolutely gorgeous, right? You've just got to savor them because you're not sure how many you're going to get.
Yeah, we're back in the 80s today, which seems odd for the early May. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Remember Arthur Keith? He's the guy who was shot in the back by Cuyahoga Metropolitan Housing Authority police while children at a Cleveland rec center were watching. Layla, what happened to the lawsuit against CMHA over that shooting?
This lawsuit got thrown out this week. U.S. District Judge Patricia Goen ruled that CMHA officer James Griffiths acted in an objectively reasonable way and that 19-year-old Arthur Keith posed an immediate threat to the officer before Griffiths shot Keith in the King Kennedy apartment complex in November of 2020. The lawsuit was filed by Arthur Keith's mother in 2022, and it said that Keith was unarmed and that Griffiths shot Keith in the back as he was running away from the officers. CMHA police said officers were called on consecutive days about a van that was parked in the parking lot. Police believed it may have been connected to an armed robbery. And in his deposition, Griffiths said that Keith got out of the van with a gun in his left hand. He took a couple steps, turned, and pointed the gun at him. Griffiths said that he was afraid for his life, and so he shot Keith. After Keith was shot, he ran around the corner of a building and then collapsed. Officers said the gun was found near Keith's body, but no photographs were taken of that gun near Keith because there was a large crowd that had gathered, and officers secured the gun in a police cruiser. There was also no footage at all of these events because CMHA police didn't wear body cams at the time, and CMHA surveillance cameras that would have recorded this entire thing were broken. And the judge said witness accounts were either inconsistent or people didn't clearly see what happened. Keith's DNA was found on the gun. She also said the autopsy showed that Keith wasn't squarely shot in the back, but rather on the far left side, which she felt corroborated the officer's story that Keith had the gun in his left hand and was turning to point the gun at the officer. The family hasn't decided yet if they're going to appeal this ruling.
The saddest part about this was the kids that were witness to what went on after. They were pretty traumatized by it. We were spending time back then at that rec center for our Greater Cleveland Project, right. So we really understood where they were coming from.
Yeah, this happened really not far from the Boys and Girls Club. And that's a neighborhood that's very familiar with trauma. And this was a really terrible, even to read the story again, it breaks the heart.
Okay, you're listening to Today in Ohio. Joanne Fabrics, the Hudson-headquartered craft retailer, filed for bankruptcy earlier this year. Lisa, is the bankruptcy already over, and how many people lost their jobs as a result?
Yeah, Joanne Fabrics emerged from bankruptcy after filing for Chapter 11 on March 18th. So they emerged about 6 weeks after they filed. They became a private company again 2 years after an initial public offering. So lenders, vendors, and other industry parties were given ownership of Joanne, and the publicly traded shares were canceled. The Joanne chain managed to eliminate this deal managed to eliminate $500 million in debt, which is about half of their $1 billion total. In a release, Joanne's officials said they're now in the best financial position in recent history. There are 815 stores. There are 18,200 employees, most of them working in the stores, but there were no closures of stores and no layoffs in connection with the bankruptcy.
It was interesting to think about the history of this company. It just started as a haberdashery in Cleveland and expanded to multiple stores, and now has grown into this behemoth that people cared a great deal about because for crafters, they provide a lot of things you really can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, I have a friend who's a fiber artist in Worcester, and she was panicking over this because Michaels doesn't offer I can't think of any other fabric store, unless it's a specialty store, that offers as much sewing stuff as Joanne does. So this is good news for a lot of people.
All right, you're listening to Today in Ohio. For the second time in a week, an appeals court has tossed the conviction of someone because of speedy trial issues. Laura, who's escaping justice this time?
This is a Cleveland Heights man accused of stealing $177,000 from vulnerable victims in a credit card scam. The thing is, he's already served the time he was sentenced to, so I don't know what you do with that. But the 6th District U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that U.S. District Judge Solomon Oliver twice failed to stop this clock ticking towards Carlos Deshaun Brown's trial. And basically, there are usually when you have a trial going, when you have a court case, it takes forever. There are so many things going back and forth, and nobody goes to court immediately. But if you want a speedy trial, you are allowed to get that within 70 days of your arraignment. That's what the law said, until the time is legally stopped by all these exclusions that are used basically in every case. Well, he's saying that these didn't stop. And for one instance, there was a time he was supposed to get transferred and it took way more time and they didn't stop the clock. So this three-judge panel sent the case back to the judge, ordered whether he dismiss the case with prejudice, meaning that it concludes and there's no more conviction, or without prejudice, meaning the prosecutors could refile the case. Again, though, he's already served more time, or served the time that it was required by a sentence.
Yeah, this is the definition of a technicality. The evidence was clear enough to convict him, but because of some technical issues is why his record might be clear. I can't see why you would go to trial with him again if he's already served the penalty. What would be the fairness of that?
I don't know. And I don't know, like, if it gets vacated, does he sue the federal government and then get money for what he was serving in jail, which sounds real, like, you know, not a great outcome either. But this is what happens. There are so many technicalities in the law, and that's why everything gets appealed.
Or maybe they dismiss the case, charge him again, and make a deal that, you know, plead guilty, you get time served, and we'll walk away, and then he can't sue for some kind of wrongful conviction. Taxpayers should not have to pay anything as a result of this.
Right.
You're listening to Today in Ohio. We haven't talked about Ohio gambling revenue in a while. Layla, what did the March numbers tell us? Are people still gambling it away?
Oh, yeah. They definitely are. Reporter Sean McDonald tells us that the numbers were up in March. The state's 11 casinos and racinos collected a combined $223.5 million of revenue in March, up from $217.7 million in March of 2023. We're talking about the money kept by the gambling houses after paying out winnings, but before state taxes and fees. So revenue was up in March and it was steady in February, but it was down in January. Through 3 months, Ohio has recorded $596.8 million of gambling revenue at casinos and racinos, down from $611.6 million at this point last year. In the Cleveland market, which includes the Jack Cleveland Casino, Jack Thistle down in MGM Northfield Park, they reported a combined $69.7 million in revenue, up from $67.5 million last year. State's casinos and racinos set a record last year in reporting a combined $2.38 billion of revenue, up from $2.33 billion in 2022. That broke the yearly revenue record for the 10th time in 11 years. And all of that doesn't even include sports betting. Those numbers are kept separately. So, man, people just so willing to part with their money.
Well, maybe that's the solution for the Haslams. They could make it a football stadium / casino and use all the gambling revenue to pay the ridiculous bill that they're trying to saddle taxpayers with. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Cleveland residents who are annoyed by the Cavs playoff games being hard to find on television have a different way to watch Game 6, in which the team seeks to close out the first round against Orlando. Lisa, what is it?
Yeah, the Game 6 is in Orlando tomorrow night, and the Cavs are up 3-2 because, like you said, they could sew it up tonight. There's going to be a watch party at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse that's going to be broadcast in their Humongotron scoreboard, which has 56 wide screens along the sideline and 30 by 33 screens on the baseline, so you'll be able to see it in living color and larger than life. Admission is $5. Proceeds will go to the Cavaliers Community Foundation, helping Northeast Ohio youth. The tip-off time for the game has still not been determined, unless they did this morning. Doors will open at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse 1 hour prior to tip-off, and then the street-level concessions will be open, and they're going to have pregame events as well, like skills challenges and three free throw contests.
This is a great way to build the communal spirit of a playoff, let people get together and hopefully celebrate together. Maybe not. Maybe they'll be drowning their sorrows together. But it's good to see it, especially because so many people are angry about the television contracts that exclude them. You're listening to Today in Ohio. And meanwhile, the Guardians have come up with another way to get people into Progressive Field for a few days in September. Laura, this one's a little strange. What is it?
You can go golfing in Progressive Field. This is Upper Deck Golf, 3 days in September, the 6th through the 8th. You can play a 9-hole round throughout the park. There'll be custom greens on the field. There'll be golfing challenges at a clubhouse bar and a festival area. And it takes about 90 minutes to complete. Obviously, I don't think you'll be using your driver that much in that park. But you have chipping, putting challenges, and complimentary food and beverage. So I'm not sure how much it costs overall to do that if you're going to get the free drinks.
I imagine this will be very popular. That people.
Yeah, I mean, have you gone to Topgolf?
No.
Man, that place is packed.
That place is packed, and it is super expensive, like crazy expensive to go. And my kids love it. But yes, this is the added benefit of getting to golf inside a ballpark, which is a cool experience that only comes around every so often. I believe in 2021, they had Topgolf at Progressive Field. They've had some kind of challenges similar at Brown Stadium. But yeah, I guess they must be on the road in September for that date.
Yeah, and people love going to that stadium. It still has the wonderful downtown feel that it had when it first opened up. You're listening to Today in Ohio. That closes out the Thursday episode. Thank you for listening. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Laura. Friday, we'll wrap up the week of news.